Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Brought to you by Capital One, where you can open a savings account in about 5 minutes and earn five times the national average. Just imagine, five times more savings toward that overdue home addition, maybe even an addition on that addition. This is Banking Reimagined. What's in your wallet? Capital One, NA member FDIC.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jonathan Savage, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 11th of March, these are our main stories. Schools and businesses have been closed in a suburb north of New York City as the authorities there try to contain what is now the biggest coronavirus outbreak in the US. Democrats in another six American states are deciding who should challenge Donald Trump in November's presidential election. Also in this podcast, life in Italy is far from normal as it too fights novel coronavirus.
Well, this form will now allow me to be able to drive back to Rome. And it says here that falsifying this document could lead to prosecution.
And the gang suspected of secretly stealing from trucks as they roar along the motorway. The spread of the coronavirus in the United States has now forced the authorities to close schools and suspend public gatherings in a suburb north of New York City as the authorities try to contain one of the biggest outbreaks of the disease in the US. Nationwide, there are now over 760 cases. Vice President Mike Pence said the entire government would work together to contain the virus outbreak.
As we stand here today, the risk to the average American of contracting the coronavirus remains low, but we're absolutely determined to give every American the tools and the information that they need to protect themselves, their families, their workplace, their schools, and we're going to work together. We're going to work together to see our way through this.
Our U.S. correspondent Chris Buckler, who's in Oakland in California, told me about the measures the government's planning to take to mitigate the impact of the virus.
They're looking at a number of different things. One of the major ones is to try to find a way of ensuring people get sick pay. That is a very important one. Now, there are a number of different ways of doing this, and there are probably going to be some discussions and arguments between Republicans and Democrats, whether it's a tax break or whether they find a way of giving sick leave in another way. And part of that is just to ensure that people can take time off if they are sick, which could reduce the spread because they're not going in and spreading the coronavirus. And that is a real concern for particularly those workers who sometimes are on low wages and feel they have to go into work in order to make their rent, in order to actually provide food on their tables. Beyond that, there are a couple of industries that are affected, and the Americans are very concerned about that. The likes of the cruise ship industry, the likes of airlines. And what they're going to do is try and put in place a package of measures, could be substantial money, to try and help those businesses through what is likely to be a difficult time. Beyond that as well, there's also a look at trying to help people ensure that they can get tested, because of course it's a very different health system to some other parts of the world. It is a commercial system, it is a health sector, not a health service, and they're looking to make sure that all insurance companies will provide tests for people.
Now, I believe you're in Oakland in California, where a cruise ship hit by the virus has docked. What's the latest from that?
Yeah, I'm standing right opposite the cruise ship as I speak. The Grand Princess is right in front of me. Now, they have managed to take hundreds of passengers off the ship already, but there are still hundreds more. In fact, something like 1,500, we believe, are still on board the ship. Now, many Americans have already got off. They've been taken away to military bases where they'll have to spend 14 days in isolation in these quarantine environments. There's some Canadians that have already gone home. And as I speak at the moment, British passengers are actually starting to leave the ship. They are going to be flown back to the UK this evening in the US time and expected to arrive sometime on Wednesday afternoon in the UK. They are not going to be put in the same quarantine environment that the Americans are, but they will be asked to stay at home and stay away from people for 14 days.
Chris Buckler. Now, how would you cope if everyone in your country was told to avoid other people, only go out if absolutely necessary, and justify otherwise ordinary movements? Tuesday, with Italy's first day of an unprecedented nationwide restriction on movement to try to slow the worst coronavirus outbreak in Europe, and it left many with a surreal feeling. Shops and restaurants are closed. Town centres and streets normally bustling with people are almost entirely empty. As we record this podcast, 631 people in Italy have died from the coronavirus and more than 10,000 are confirmed to have been infected with COVID-19. So how does life look under the country's lockdown? Alessandra Maggiovanni lives in the city of Orvieto in Umbria.
People are panicking because there is a bit of confusion, because from one day to the next, there was always something different. And the measures have become more and more restrictive. It's really a surreal atmosphere. I think up to now, Italians didn't quite understand how serious and how infectious this virus is. It's so quiet. It really feels like you're at war, but there's no rockets.
University student Adele Monticelli lives just north of Milan, where measures to contain the spread of the virus have been in place for almost 3 weeks now.
Since the lockdown began, I can't attend classes at uni and lectures at university, of course. Fortunately, I can attend classes online. One thing I think we are realizing is that regardless of your background, your age, your ethnicity, and also your privilege, you can't solve this problem alone.
Sally Hooper, who's lived in Italy for decades, is in Rome.
The traffic is almost zero. People on the streets are very few, and we're all trying to keep a meter away from each other. I've just been to a couple of supermarkets. A lot of the shelves are very empty. We're not inviting any friends around. We're not seeing our family. We're keeping ourselves to ourselves. And I think everybody is doing exactly the same.
Our correspondent Mark Lowen spent the day travelling south to Rome from the northern city of Bologna.
The new reality is dawning in Italy. The heart of Europe has been quarantined with a blanket ban on gatherings and public venues closed, the toughest confinement measures since the war. Travel is prohibited without filling in a document showing urgent need or a return home, which we, as everyone, had to complete. We'd need to produce it if asked. Well, this form will now allow me to be able to drive back to Rome. And it says here that falsifying this document could lead to prosecution. Never could people in Italy have conceived of the idea that they'd need this to be able to move within their own country. Several airlines have stopped all flights here, a problem for British residents Prue Crane and Deirdre Casey.
Well, obviously, we won't be able to travel in the immediate future. We've been told that we can only take trains between cities in Italy for reasons of work or health or for some extraordinary emergency. And apart from that, we must stay put. But that seems sensible.
It just makes me feel guilty going out for a walk. And another thing is they've put this limelight or spotlight on age groups and makes me feel really, really old. But I'm optimistic about it.
Well, we've come out of Bologna now and we're on the motorway to Rome, and we haven't seen any police checks for the documents, so still not clear how these restrictions are going to be enforced. Sealing off a G7 economy and one of the world's most visited countries isn't easy, though Austria has now banned all Italians from crossing the border without medical certificates. The restrictions may not be followed and they may not work. There's just been the biggest single rise in deaths, 168 in the past day. And tonight, the Prime Minister's office is not ruling out imposing even more severe measures.
Mark Lowen. Now, officially, Italy is the country hardest hit by the COVID-19 virus after China. Some observers, though, suspect that Iran may have undercounted deaths from the virus. As we record this podcast, the authorities there say another 54 have died, taking the total to 290. Esfandiar Batmangelij works for an organisation that tracks developments in Iran's economy. He spoke to Tim Franks about the country's battle against the virus.
They have a limitation on the number of tests they can perform. Officials from the health ministry have acknowledged that there are over 16,000 hospitalizations likely linked to coronavirus. But then again, a lot of people are not presenting to the hospital, particularly if they have a minor version of the virus.
You mentioned that perhaps there's been a lack of testing. Has that been, as far as you're able to track, down to
political will, the sort of sense of sweeping it under the carpet, or just actually a lack of testing kits.
Iran did quickly run out of tests as the outbreak spread in that first week or so. But at the same time, you can imagine that in some instances, the testing is probably being dissuaded, precisely because I think at some point, the public health system is trying to just treat the illnesses as they manifest, rather than at this stage, trying to contain and understand the spread.
As far as the public health response is concerned, what are we seeing? Are we seeing similar measures, similar restrictions that we've been in China or indeed now in Italy?
We have yet to see a full-on quarantines of whole sort of cities or regions in Iran. And there's been a lot of consternation in Iran, both among officials and private sector leaders and members of civil society, around at what point is a quarantine the right move and at what point is it not going to add significant benefits and yet have other harms, such as economic harms. Because, of course, this crisis is hitting Iran on the back of 2 years of significant economic recession. And those trade-offs are quite difficult. I think there's also a concern in government about the enforceability of any quarantine. Because after all, the initial sort of messages to the public to limit travel were not heeded. And a lot of residents of some of the major cities like Tehran traveled north to provinces and actually took the virus with them.
One thinks of Iran as being an authoritarian country where there is fairly tight central control. But you're suggesting that actually perhaps their ability to have these very tight social orders are limited.
I think it's less authoritarian than we often believe, and that cuts in multiple ways. So on one hand, it means that perhaps the government is less able to actually impose that sort of martial control that certainly we saw in China. But on the other hand, it also means that when we have a conversation around things like the transparency of the public health response, and we wonder about the veracity of the official statistics, we should remember that there's a very healthy discourse in Iran that's similarly questioning the veracity of those statistics.
Iran certainly has been battered by sanctions over recent years. How far do you think that is contributing to shortages of the sorts of equipment, medication that might be useful in combating the disease?
I think there's a clear indication that that's what's taking place. On one hand, you have a systemic vulnerability because you have an economy that's been in a weak position for a long time. So that comes down to things like households maybe having already exhausted their savings if they were to then have to go into a quarantine type period. But on the other hand, there's the specific issue around the ability for Iran to replenish supplies of medical equipment and medicine that it imports, and also to bring in the raw materials for the goods that it produces domestically. And there are really two challenges faced there. One is that Iran, because of sanctions, has a very degraded banking tie, so it's difficult to, in a timely fashion, facilitate payments for a lot of these goods. And then on the other hand, because of the way that a lot of the regional countries are starting to close borders, Iran, which was sort of unusually reliant on re-export through countries like the UAE and the port of Dubai, or through Turkey and the logistics hubs in the east of the country, is finding it difficult to actually find the physical routes to keep those supply chains going.
Esfandjar Batmangelic. As we record this podcast, another six US states are voting on who they want to be the next Democratic Party candidate for the White House. The former Vice President Joe Biden and the left-wing Senator Bernie Sanders are the only two serious contenders left in the race. Jane O'Brien reports.
Michigan, I'm counting on you in a big way.
With 125 delegates, Michigan is indeed the state that could play a deciding role in choosing who will take on Donald Trump in November. Joe Biden, whose campaign was declared all but dead a week ago, is now the national front runner. A big win here would help consolidate his lead. But Michigan is a state that has delivered primary upsets before. Bernie Sanders, Biden's only serious challenger, narrowly beat Hillary Clinton here in 2016, despite her advantage in the polls. He needs Michigan now to stay in the race.
Jane O'Brien. You're listening to the Global News Podcast on the BBC World Service. Still to come.
When you speak to the women who've been through all these terrible things about, you know, what can be done for them, all of them I spoke to, whether it was in Bosnia or Argentina or Congo or Philippines, all of them said the thing we really want is justice.
The widespread use of rape as a weapon of war. They're becoming an increasingly common sight in many cities. E-scooters are those step-on, step-off two-wheelers which look like a child's toy but have an electric motor attached and usually travel at speeds of nearly 25 kilometres an hour. Their fans argue that if regulated properly, e-scooters can make a major contribution to reducing traffic congestion, but they remain illegal in some countries, including the UK. Paul Moss went to one spot in Britain where they are allowed.
Well, this is certainly a different way to get to work. I'm now scooting along through what was the Olympic Park in Stratford, just going past West Ham United's new stadium. I think what surprises you is they do accelerate very quickly, but yeah, once you get used to it, it's pretty stable, although it's very sunny, so really the perfect weather for using this. I'm just going to pull over here now, because watching me patiently learning how to use this is Harry Porter from the company Bird, which makes these scooters and also rents them out here in Stratford. Harry, how's the business going?
So here in Stratford in the Olympic Park, business is going very well, actually. So we see tens of thousands of people coming here and trying the service out. It's a great way to get across the park. You get the wind on your face, and it's a really lovely way to commute.
It does feel a little unstable, I guess, on a windy day. You might worry about being blown off course.
I think with all these things, it takes a bit of practice. So we actually have events. People can come down, learn how to ride a scooter properly, 5 minutes on one of these, and you'll be away.
It is actually against the law to ride e-scooters on Britain's roads. The Stratford site counts officially as private land. They're also illegal in the Netherlands. But in many cities across Europe, e-scooters are proving very popular. And indeed in the US and Australia, where some states do allow them. There are also now e-scooter rental schemes up and running in countries like Mexico, Chile and Canada. The idea in many of these places is to encourage people onto public transport. As Cohen Kennis, a local councillor in the Belgian city of Antwerp, explained to me, people will catch a train or bus if they have a way to reach their final destination at the other end.
What we see in Antwerp is that a lot of people, in the past, they took their car to work because they can go from the front of their home to their company. When you go by public transport, you go, for instance, with the train, and then at the station, you have to walk 1 or 2 kilometers. And what is the difference now with the e-scooter? It's very easy to go from the train station to the front of your workplace.
I gather you are something of an e-scooter enthusiast yourself.
Well, I use, for instance, the scooter when I have to go from the one meeting to another meeting or to a reception. When you go by a bicycle and it's hot, then it can be that you are very sweaty at the end. And the advantage of an e-scooter is that you don't have the same problem.
I am Emily Hartridge and I have a YouTube channel called 10 Reasons Why.
She had already made a name for herself as a YouTube presence. But last year, Emily Hartridge achieved fame for something more tragic. After colliding with a lorry, she became the first person in Britain to be killed riding an e-scooter.
I started my channel because...
Emily Hartridge was using her scooter illegally on the road. And in fact, Britain's Royal Society for the Prevention of Accidents says that e-scooters need not be dangerous, despite accidents like this making the headlines. But the Society's traffic spokesman Nick Lloyd says they do need to be regulated, both the vehicles themselves and the places where they're used.
E-scooters have been used widely across the world, and evidence shows that in countries which have had deregulation, they've been used on pavements, which has created dangers for pedestrians. Where they've been rented, they've been left in places which have become trip hazards. They've been, if you like, causing street clutter. So the evidence is that when they're not regulated correctly, they're not only a danger to the e-scooter riders themselves, but they're a danger to pedestrians especially.
Britain's Transport Ministry says it will consider legalising e-scooters at some point. A spokesman acknowledged that introducing them could be part of a process which can transform the way people and goods move around cities.
Paul Moss. The King of the Netherlands, Willem-Alexander, has apologised to Indonesia. The apology was for the excessive violence used by Dutch forces in the 1940s as it struggled to put down an independence movement. Michael Bristow reports.
The Dutch king said Indonesia's attempts to free itself from its colonial ruler had been a painful separation which had cost many lives. In a speech at the start of a state visit to Indonesia, he said the past could not be erased and would have to be acknowledged by each generation.
I would like to express and repeat regret and apologies for the excessive violence on the part of the Dutch in those years. And I do so in the full realization that the pain and sorrow of the families affected continue to be felt today.
Indonesia declared independence from the Netherlands in 1945, but that wasn't accepted by the Dutch until 4 years later. In the meantime, they fought to keep their colony, leading to a number of atrocities. In 1947, more than 200 Indonesian men were executed in a field in front of a local government office in South Sulawesi. The government of the Netherlands has said sorry before and offered compensation, but this is the first apology by a Dutch monarch. Indonesia's president, Joko Widodo, said the King's state visit would concentrate on the future without forgetting the past. But some of those whose relatives died in those bloody years say the Dutch need to make more specific apologies and make sure everyone is compensated.
Michael Bristow. For as long as there's been war, there's been rape. But while we have countless histories of killing, there's been far less written about the sexual violence that's accompanied so much conflict. Christina Lam has tried to change that. She's one of Britain's most experienced war reporters, chief foreign correspondent at the Sunday Times newspaper. The BBC's Tim Frank spoke to her about her new book, Our Bodies, Their Battlefield.
I wanted to write this book because I've worked as a foreign correspondent for 33 years and mostly covering conflict. And the last few years, I've seen more violence against women, sexual violence, than any time previously in my career. And I couldn't understand why that should be the case.
And what conclusion did you draw?
Mostly, I'm afraid, because of impunity. For example, the Yazidis were the first people and women and girls that I got to know who had really suffered these things and had been taken as sex slaves and, you know, passed on from one ISIS fighter to another. And those stories were well reported. Some of those women bravely came forward and spoke about their ordeal. Nadia Murad sort of became the face of the Yazidis, won a Nobel Peace Prize. And yet there hasn't been a single prosecution of any of the ISIS fighters who did this. And it's not that they haven't been caught. There are plenty in jails in Iraq and Syria and elsewhere. So then I realised the same thing. I went to Nigeria. I spoke to lots of the women that had been taken by Boko Haram. I will mostly remember the Chibok girls, but tens of thousands of other women were also taken. And again, the Rohingya, who were really brutally raped by the Burmese military, who burnt down their huts, tied them to banana trees and gang raped them in front of their children. And all these things happened within a few years.
But you say that there was complete impunity, and yet one thinks of rape being used as a weapon of war for time immemorial. So
yes,
I guess
right.
my question is, why do you think that there's been a greater incidence of it now? Because it's not as if there's been a long history of successful prosecutions for rape as a weapon of war.
Well, I mean, I think there's two different things. I mean, there's always been rape in war, not necessarily as a weapon. I mean, often just in the sort of chaos of war when all sort of normal rules are gone, and also people, soldiers being given women as a reward, if you like. And then there's cases where soldiers or fighters are told specifically that this is your duty. And so ISIS, for example, were told it was their religious duty to capture Yazidis because they were so-called devil worshippers. So it's quite hard to generalise. It's different cases. But I do think, you know, society has developed and progressed, and things that maybe were somehow seen as acceptable centuries ago certainly are not now.
And I mean, there is certainly, I don't know how effective it is, but there's certainly more awareness of this now. There seem to be international campaigns, there are rapporteurs, people talk about this becoming, well, clearly it is outlawed and it needs to be outlawed, but actually something being, in a sense, done about it.
Yes, I mean, there is more awareness, but that's why I found it so shocking that there was actually so little being done in terms of justice. Because when you speak to the women who've been through all these terrible things about, you know, what can be done for them, all of them I spoke to, whether it was in Bosnia or Argentina or Congo or Philippines, all of them said the thing we really want is justice, because they don't want it to happen to anyone else. And of course, you know, rape is difficult to prosecute anyway. Obviously, in war situations where people running the country or ruling your local area are the perpetrators themselves and have all the weapons, it is even harder.
And I suppose aggravating the awfulness of the incident or incidents themselves is the fact that so often women, girls end up being stigmatised for the fact that they've had this violence wrought upon them.
That's the thing I found saddest, really, that to have gone through all this and then for your community or family not to take you back. And, you know, you were the person that was the victim, and yet you're being treated as though you've done something wrong or have some reason for shame. And that is so sad. The other thing that's really sad too is the children of rape and what happens to them, because often the women find it very hard to look after them because they're a constant reminder of the worst days of their lives.
Christina Lam. Let's return to our main story, and Pope Francis has called on Catholic priests to visit coronavirus patients, a request that appears to contradict advice from Italian officials.
Preghiamo il Signore anche per I nostri sacerdoti.
Let us pray to the Lord also for our priests. May they have the courage to go out to sick people, bringing them the strength of the Lord's word and the Eucharist. May they accompany healthcare professionals and volunteers in the work they are doing.
The Pope himself live-streamed a religious service at the weekend instead of holding the event in St. Peter's Square in the Vatican. I asked our religion editor Martin Bashir what he made of the Pope's comments.
We know, for example, that the Catholic Church is probably the biggest non-governmental social care organisation in the world, operating more than 20,000 health facilities, and that's to say nothing of the 200,000 Catholic parishes around the world that offer support to the sick. The 2016 Zika crisis saw Catholic healthcare charities offering help around the world. And so although the advice is that people should not group together, should not travel and so on, there is this sense in the very earliest manifestation of the church that that is a calling for Christian people.
Across religious communities, coming together, being with other people, worshipping together, forms a huge part of so many different cultures. How is the coronavirus outbreak affecting these traditions?
At the end of July, the Hajj will take place, the pilgrimage to Mecca in Saudi Arabia. Last year, 2.2 million Muslims made that pilgrimage. Well, imagine then that number of people, and it's no surprise that there's consideration being given by the Saudi Arabian government about whether the Hajj simply shouldn't take place. You'll know the Saudi Arabian government has already halted travel to the holiest sites of the Middle East following something like 300 cases of the coronavirus. The other thing that's worth mentioning as well in relation to Islam is the epicenter in the Middle East's most affected country, Iran, appears to be in the holy Shia city of Qom. And in that city is a shrine where the faithful reach out to kiss and to touch it in reverence. So that's clearly going to have an effect in terms of Islam. In terms of the Catholic Church, on Ash Wednesday, there was not a single service in the entire Archdiocese of Milan. Now, Ash Wednesday is the third most attended liturgy of the Catholic Church after Easter and Christmas. So here's a question for you. Is it possible that for the first time since the establishment of an independent Vatican City State in 1929, that the celebration of Mass on Easter Sunday could actually be cancelled due to this outbreak of coronavirus?
Martin Bashir asking that question. It's a story that sounds more like something out of a Hollywood blockbuster than real life. A Romanian gang that pulled off heists roaring along motorways on trucks has been targeted in a pan-European operation. Our Europe editor, Mike Sanders, told me how they did it.
I suppose I'd better preface this by saying that although it sounds, you know, very glamorous in a way, these raids were extremely dangerous, and the Dutch police say they did put other road users at great risk. So, but what they actually did was, in some cases, they swarmed around a targeted lorry with vehicles that were going front and side to keep it steady at a steady pace and on a steady lane. And then another vehicle would drive up right behind, so close that they could actually clamber onto the bonnet of the moving vehicle, undo the doors or get under the tarpaulin of the lorry and get inside and then take the goods out and hand them back to the following vehicle. Now, these raids, there were 700 actually Romanian police were involved in raids on 73 premises and 40 arrests there. And Eurojust, which is the European Union's justice agency in The Hague, says in total 71 people are facing charges.
To take these risks, the prize must have been quite highly valued. Do you know what the goods were?
Mainly high-end stuff like smartphones, laptops, tablets, that kind of things. Things that could be easily picked up and transferred into a following vehicle. The Dutch police have put the value of the gear at 10 million euros, which is slightly more in dollars. The euro just put it slightly under that.
And the lorry drivers didn't notice?
They didn't notice. It does seem incredible, doesn't it? But if you're that close to the back of a vehicle, obviously the vehicles that were trailing were narrower than the lorry, so you can't see in the wing mirrors. And it is possible. And any, of course, bangs and bumps as they were unloading might have been put down to bangs and bumps in the road. So it is possible. It wasn't always like that. They did also have another modus operandi, which was they emptied one truck inside a ferry that was travelling from Finland to Sweden while the driver was up on deck.
Our Europe editor, Mike Sanders. And that's all from us for now. But there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this edition or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Jonathan Savage. Until next time, goodbye.
Capital One has a fresh take on banking. Now you can open a new savings account in about 5 minutes and earn 5 times the national average. Banking with Capital One means 5 times the savings toward your dream honeymoon, or 5 times the savings toward your family's ultimate vacation, even 5 times the savings toward just feeling good about saving. It's time to make your savings goals come true. This is Banking Reimagined. What's in your wallet? Capital One, N.A. member FDIC.